Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm with Veterans for Peace Daniel Ellsberg Chapter 92 in Seattle. And with me are Aaron Miracle and Matt Rhodes, who are both veterans, Iraq veterans, and of members also of About Face, which is an activist organization. And I'll let them sort of explain what that is and what they're doing right now. So, you want to go first, Aaron?
Sure. As you said, I'm Aaron Miracle. I'm a member of the South Sound crew of About Face Veterans Against the War. We are located primarily in Tacoma, but we have a pretty large geographic area that we serve right now. And we are post-9/11 veterans that are organizing around anti-imperialism, anti-fascism. Yeah, most of us and our crew have deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. That's kind of our age range. Currently, I deployed to Iraq in 2007, 2008, during what's called the troop surge, and came back home, left the military on a hardship discharge, and started organizing with About Face. And our current organizing that we want to talk about today is around veterans in detention centers, immigrant veterans and their issues. We're pretty passionate about that issue because we recognize that our military service is a major contributor to global migration. Militarism abroad, wars, and climate change driven by US militarism are the biggest creators of immigration on the globe. People fleeing war, people fleeing climate change, coming to this country for a better life. And so we feel that we have an obligation to engage with this issue of detainees. Matt, I'll let you talk.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Matt Rhodes. I served in the Navy as an aviation ordnanceman, early 2000s. I was honorably discharged in 2003, two deployments with patrol and reconnaissance squadron. I actually joined Veterans for Peace in 2006, around the time that the convention was at the University of Washington in Seattle. And that's when I ran into a new organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I started organizing with them. That is the predecessor to About Face, the organization that I'm both me and Aaron are part of now. I think he kind of covered most of what I had to say about that. Permanent war. Military weapons tactics in this country, not okay. I mean, they're not okay everywhere, but they're definitely not okay in Minneapolis or Seattle or any other country here. I would say we're intimately familiar with the inner workings of the world's largest military, and we try to use that knowledge, that information, and our personal experiences to expose the truth about what's going on overseas and obviously what's coming home to roost now because of all that.
So, what sort of a reaction do you get from other veterans of any kind of any wars when you tell them that you're actually an anti-war veteran, an anti-imperialist veteran? And I mean, you've had conversations, I would imagine, with civilians and ex and vets too about what you're doing. And so, what sort of the reaction does the as far as you can tell me, what was the reaction of the public to what you're doing? And specifically about, you mentioned earlier that the one of the issues, one of the main issues, is incarcerated veterans.
Yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag with people. I talk to veterans and they're like, I didn't realize that there were other veterans like me that were opposed to the war. And they often end up joining us in our cause. I meet veterans who, you're betraying your oath, you're betraying your country, you're a traitor. So it kind of runs the spectrum between I'm with you and I'm very much against you. Civilians in general just seem to be enamored with like the veteran mystique. And so they accept most of what I have to say kind of whole cloth, because I'm a veteran and I have that privilege. When I tell them that they're detained veterans in the ICE concentration camps, civilians especially are really shocked. They tend to assume that military service automatically confers citizenship. And so people, both veterans, but especially civilians, are really shocked when they find out that there are currently three veterans detained in ICE concentration camps and a fourth that was recently released from the concentration camp.
There's three that we're aware of, and one thing that I would hope that getting some publicity about this issue would help would be to locate any others, because based on what we know about those four individuals that Aaron mentioned, the numbers indicate there's more. We just need to find them.
Well,
And we want to help them. So,
how did these vets end up in custody? I mean, locked up.
Zahid Chowdhury, who is a member of Veterans for Peace, he is the president of the Rachel Corrie chapter down in Olympia, has had run-ins with immigration since the Obama administration. They've been trying to deport him. They say that he falsified some paperwork. I've seen the paperwork and it's not his handwriting. I think what truly happened is he was asked by the FBI post 9/11 to spy on his local mosque and he refused to do so. And since then, he's been harassed pretty consistently by the government and has been fighting for citizenship. He's never violated a US law, he's in the country lawfully. He's a green card holder. He was at a naturalization hearing when he was originally detained by ICE and taken to the Northwest Detention Center, where he was for from August to December. He was released on a habeas appeal in December because the government admitted that his detention was illegal and that he never should have been detained. He still is fighting for naturalization, and we're supporting him in that fight, so that he can remain in the country with his wife and two small children who are US citizens. Garnett Smith had some minor brushes with the law, violation of a protection order. His ex-girlfriend kept calling him about seeing his kids, those kinds of things, and so he violated the restraining order. He was apprehended at work in Spokane and put into ICE detention over the summer. Kimless Tech had an assault. And served a 15-year prison sentence for assault. During that prison sentence, he attended school, he attended therapy, he rehabilitated himself. And when he was released, rather than being able to go about his life after having served his sentence, he was detained by ICE. Godfrey Wade in Georgia, well, he was in Georgia detention. He's now in Louisiana. He was recently moved. Was driving without a driver's license and pulled over and picked up for that, and then told, "You missed an immigration hearing. You have a warrant out for your arrest because you missed an immigration hearing." But the government has actually admitted in his case that the notice for the immigration hearing that he missed was sent to the wrong address. So by their own rules, he shouldn't be detained because their rules are very specific that if it's sent to the wrong address, they're not supposed to hold that against you. So that's kind of how those four veterans have found themselves in this situation. But all four were promised citizenship through military service, and all four have honorable discharges from the US military. They should have been naturalized long ago. None of them should be in this situation.
I do some have done for years anyway, a fair amount of work going into schools and talking, and we call it counter recruiting, and truth and recruiting, and recruiters used to do this fairly often. It is illegal for recruiters to say something that or promise something that is not true, and there is no by joining the military there is no easy path to becoming a citizenship. And that's one of the reasons they do actually recruit, particularly minority students, usually into the military. And that's a bogus sort of thing, and it's a basically criminal sort of part. And recruiters are actually restrained from doing this. It's illegal for them to do so, but they do it all the time. As far as reactions to people, I have actually been to a class, it's been a few years, and I was talking about the war and my own experiences, and had a kid say, he said, "I can't even believe that you're in here talking about this." He says, "How'd they let you in?" Which is actually, I take it as a privilege to go and talk to these kids, but they had not heard anything that contradicted all the stuff that they'd ever heard all their life about the war and militarism, this sort of thing. So it was like it's a shock. And I think that what you guys are talking about have veterans locked up for petty, for the most part, petty sort of specious sort of offenses after they've served. The military is very troubling.
I would add, in relation to Mr. Wade Godfrey, he was pulled over for having a taillight out and arrested for not having a license. But in the state of Georgia, someone who doesn't have citizenship papers can't get a license. So, he was kind of put in this position where, he was carrying on his daily life and, they turned that into a criminal act, and seems intentional. And then to have this guy who's got six children, three grandchildren, a member of the community, just whisked away and, treated really poorly, is it's not a mistake. It's intentional.
Now, there's also, do you deal with actually deported veterans? I think that there's actually a VFP chapter in Mexico, or maybe El Paso or Tijuana,
Tijuana, yeah.
Tijuana, yeah, fighting their deportations. I don't know if have you got any information about those veterans?
Yeah, so in Tijuana, there's actually it's called the Bunker, and it's a house that was started by a deported veteran, who actually has returned to the US now, but for 16 years he was in Mexico and ran the deported veterans house. And then he received a pardon for his original conviction and returned to the United States and was naturalized. And we really hope that the veterans that we're working with right now that are facing deportation are able to do the same. Currently, three of them have deportation orders, Tech to Cambodia, and Godfrey and Garnett to Jamaica, all have pending deportation orders that they are appealing at as we speak. So their deportations are in theory imminent.
Well, as an aside, well, not an aside, a group of these deported veterans showed up in Auburn last Veterans Day, Armistice Day, in their traveling van, and marched with us and specifically brought attention to their causes, deported veterans, So, what are you guys doing as far as promoting or bringing awareness of these issues to the public, and how do you do that?
We've done a lot of different things. We've done workshops with veterans, and also with youth in our community. I work in a youth center, and so I've done workshops to raise awareness with the youth, and they've written letters to their representatives. I've done workshops with other veterans, with About Face members, to have them write to their representatives. And we have a press conference on January 30th at noon in front of the Northwest Detention Center, where we'll be raising awareness of this issue in the media. Because Kristi Noem lied. She said that we don't deport veterans, and that's just fundamentally not true. We deport an unknown number of veterans because ICE doesn't keep track of it, but we know it's in the thousands that have been deported.
So, I mean, for them, what access do they have if they're deported this in another country? They're shut out of luck, basically. I mean, it's a long hoe back to get back into the States one way or the other.
Yeah, and they lose access to veterans' health care because there's no VAs in these countries that they're deported to. So they lose access to the benefits of their service. And it's also important to note it's a national security risk to be deporting people who know how our military operates. To other countries. Like, that's a national security risk. Some of these people had security clearances, and you're deporting them to other countries where they could potentially be recruited to do horrible things or attempt to be recruited to do horrible things and be harmed because they don't comply with those things. That's a very real risk that these people face when they're deported to places like Mexico, where there are cartels that want their military knowledge, places in the Middle East that will persecute them because they were in the US military. Like, they are not being deported into safe settings.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting remark, Aaron, because some of these people actually, for one reason or another, might actually say, especially if they've got combat training and small unit tactics, that sort of thing, they said, "Well, hell with it. I'm going to help train these people to militaries in this country to make trouble for the United States." You know, that's a possibility.
And they may not really have a lot of other choice.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody's getting deported to one of these countries where they have no family, they may have never been there in their entire life, they're going to possibly be recruited, and that might be their best option, or maybe their only option.
Yeah, you take a case like Kinless Tech. He was born in a Thai refugee camp to Cambodian parents. Thailand will not take him back because he's not a Thai national, because neither of his parents are Thai. And Cambodia may not take him back because he joined a foreign military. And in Cambodia, the law is joining a foreign military is officially a renunciation of your citizenship. So there's the very real risk that Heck is not deportable to Cambodia or Thailand, and the government will be placed in a position where they deport him to a third country like South Sudan, where there's the very real risk of harm coming to him or him being exploited to do harm to others because of his military training as an infantryman.
So, sort of getting back your both of yours military experience, what specifically led you to this sort of positions about militarism and war? What did you do and what did you see?
I started out in aviation, but I was told pretty early on in my aviation career that they were eliminating promotion potential for that field and gave me the opportunity to change my military occupational specialty. So I became military police, and I deployed as a military police sergeant. And while I was there, I met an interpreter named Ahmed Shayal, but he went by Adam Ellis with American folks. And he had actually saved a US soldier's life, and was given special permission on base to like utilize the PX and the MWR facilities and all of that, which was not normal for an Iraqi national to have access to those things. But that's how significant his service was, that he had saved a soldier's life. And one of the things that happened is one of the units he worked with gave him an iPod Shuffle. They had just come out, they were like brand new. And so he had this iPod Shuffle, and the problem is it was considered contraband for him to have because it's removable media. They treated it like a thumb drive and said, "You could use that to insert things into our computers or steal information from our computers. You're not allowed to have that." And so they kicked him off base. And the problem is his identity had been protected. His community, except for his parents, thought that he went overseas to go to school. That way, his family would be safe and nobody would know that he was working with the US forces. And so, when he suddenly appeared being dropped off in a Humvee by military forces, the jig was up and everybody found out where he had been and what he'd been doing. And 3 days later, the insurgency assassinated his entire family. They were executed in the street. And when I found out that that had happened, that was the turning point for me. I realized that everything that I thought I knew about how the system worked, everything I thought about fairness and justice was a lie. This person who had put his life at risk to help us was just thrown away like trash over an iPod Shuffle. And I realized that things were not as what I thought they were. So that was like my radicalizing moment. And there were lots of other things that happened, but that's the one that stands out most in my mind.
And Matt?
I think for me, there's not a single moment that was as clear as what Aaron just said. I spent some time in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. We were flying out of there, and Bahrain and Qatar, and it was very clear to me that the narrative that I was seeing on the news was contradictory to my lived experience, what I was seeing, the way that support personnel on bases were being treated. It was just clear to me that the bill of sale that the American people were being sold was not true. And so when I got home, I thought that it was my responsibility to tell people that what they were being told was not true. And I naively thought at that time, as a 20-something-year-old person, that would do the trick if people just knew that the imperialism that we were exporting to the world was not what they were seeing on the news, that they might wake up and stop it. Clearly now, 20 years later, not
You
true.
know, when I was in the military, and my reaction to the military was, well, similar. I saw a lot of people killed, a lot of civilians killed, many, and including children. And it was traumatic. It remains a piece of my traumatic memory. But the other thing is that people don't believe you when you say, well, I saw this jet come in and blow apart a village. And I don't know. So there were a lot of there may have been some enemy in there, but there were a lot of civilians, and they don't care. So they say, well, we wouldn't do something like that. That's for people who you mentioned sort of earlier. This is that we don't operate that way. Well, we do. I mean, our recent thing in Venezuela. I don't know how many other people they killed. They don't say how many civilians were killed in this operation. So. People do not want to believe what's in front of them, and that is, if a veteran is saying, "I saw these people being killed, and they were civilians and kids." So, I mean, what do you say to somebody like that? He says, "No, this is what I saw. This is what I know."
I mean, I don't know if you watched videos today, but I watched videos of a nurse, a VA nurse, being executed on the streets in Minneapolis today. Watched it in slow motion from a lot of different angles. Like, I saw what happened with my eyes, and the amount of live video coverage of these events now happening with the militarism of, the Proud Boys, ICE, whatever, in the United States. Like, it's very clear to see. And they can say that these things went down a different way, but there is no fog of war here, right? There's nothing here that's like, well, you don't understand how it was. It was a very very complicated dynamic situation. But like, no, this was actually a US city, and we all saw what you did. So hopefully that will shed some light on, like, well, if they're lying to you about this to your face, what else are they lying about? Everything, essentially. Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
the
just.
unfortunate thing is that probably a good number of these ICE thugs are vets themselves. Some of them are would be, I would have bet. And then, of course, the police departments traditionally have a lot of veterans in them too. So you've got these populations of veterans, kind of on one side or the other. And then, of course, the National Guard, who are many of them are many of their men are active duty. Vets, you've got all these veterans from different sort of scenarios. I mean, they were thinking. I don't know. Did they put any National Guard on? I think this governor said he threatened to put National Guard into Minneapolis if it got any worse. I don't know, but I mean, you've got this scenario where you've got many veterans who are involved in this, and they end up being sort of victims themselves of this violence.
Yeah, when I go visit our detained veterans at Northwest Detention Center, I walk by a truck almost every time. One of the guards is a Purple Heart infantryman veteran, and he's a guard now in an ICE facility. That's what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, their veterans are definitely represented all throughout both sides of the struggle, right? Like, there's lots of people on the ICE fascist side, and then there's lots of veterans who are struggling against that. So we're it's an interesting dynamic that you've got veterans on both sides of this divide. And what is it that makes people choose one side or the other? That is what I would love to figure out so we could influence more people over to our side of things.
Well, one of the things, hardest things that I think for veterans, especially who are come have some conflicted opinions about what they saw and did, is that hardest thing you can do is look in the mirror and say, well, what was that, and what did I do, and what was it for? It's a burden really for people who've seen combat or know what is happening in the military, and say, well, I was a part of that, It's not an easy burden for a lot of soldiers. So how many people are do you think are involved in About Face?
Oh, like nationally?
Yeah.
I think the last count I saw is we have, a few thousand members that are considered active. Our roles are much bigger because we have lots of people who join and then never really get involved with the
Right,
work.
yeah.
But I would say we've got a few thousand active members that are actively doing the work and engaging with the organization meaningfully. And then our local crew has, I would say, about 20 of us now in the local South Sound crew.
18.
So we're just
Okay.
start, we're just starting out this year. The local crew was dormant for a long time, and this past year is when we've really gotten active again. And there's about 20 of us or so that are really engaging with the work locally now.
Now, do you have any communication with, say, organizations in Minnesota, for example, or before that at LA, about what's
Yeah,
happening?
we've got About Face members in Minnesota. I spoke to one this morning.
And what can I tell you outside of what you've seen in the videos and
They actually gave us a really good debrief last night about how to engage with this work, how to use signal chats to have running dialogues between people that are doing observation operations on ICE and things like that. So they're on the ground doing a lot of observation, trying to film, trying to keep ICE accountable. But it's hard to know what to do because, as we've seen, it's incredibly dangerous work. They're shooting people in the streets simply for filming them.
Yeah, I've got a local group here, a neighborhood group that is going through the sort of recommendations for what do we do about ICE in the neighborhood. I live on Capitol Hill, Seattle. They really haven't showed up here yet, but we're sort of getting primed for it. Personally, I would be very loath to get anywhere near these people. They're very dangerous. They're armed. They don't have much training, apparently, in crowd dynamics. So.
I think what I've heard from folks across the country is that establishing those communications networks before the occupation is really important. So anyone who is organizing with Veterans for Peace or About Face or any other organization that's in opposition to the this occupation of U.S. cities, what I've heard is try to establish communications beforehand, and have a plan rather than trying to scramble when they're already, going down Broadway.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're doing right now. It's centered around Meany School, and the organization. A woman who's led that organization there was a teacher and a I think she's a self-described socialist or communist, but she's a union member, and for they it took them several weeks to get the school and the district involved, as they because these are in the case of Meany, most of those kids are not white. And they are vulnerable. vulnerable kids, and you have to, as a teacher or administrator, you have to, you don't want to get them too scared, or they'll be dysfunctional. Apparently, that's happening to quite a few students. They're actually experiencing symptoms of PTSD. They're frightened. So fortunately, the school district or the district, the principal there has acknowledged that what the problem is, and they've taken some remedial steps to deal with ICE. Not one of the things is that when they show up, don't let them in, which is really a simple sort of thing. But some of these kids are, they'll let anybody in the building because they're authority. But so anyway, that's one of the things that they can do, then organize carpools so that people can go to school safely. I've lucky enough to actually have a Mexican woman who I've known for almost 20 years come and help me clean the house, and now she's too afraid to go downtown and transfer the bus. So if I want her to come to clean my help me clean my house, I gotta go bury it and get her, and that's as for many people, that's kind of a luxury to have, but still doesn't diminish her sort of fear of being deported.
I think, we're witnessing inherently racist, state-sponsored violence. The administration has disdain for the Constitution. They're unconstrained by a Supreme Court that they bought. So when they say we're going to demand papers from anybody who looks brown or speaks with an accent, and the rest of us say, like, I really didn't like the Fourth Amendment anyway, screw it. That the only other theoretical check would be the Congress, and they're too afraid of the administration to do anything. So the Congress is useless, the Supreme Court is useless, and so what's left is us. I honestly believe that like no one's coming to save us here. I just feel like it's if these people are uncomfortable by being called out for being racist, they should stop doing racist shit. And then perhaps we could get beyond that. But it's mind-boggling to me when there's this feigned indignation about being labeled as a racist. Like it's literally racist to unconstitutionally stop a person, citizen or no, and demand papers. Like it's against the Constitution. It's
Well,
not ambiguous.
their default sort of thing is to call everybody a terrorist.
Right.
I mean, Good was a terrorist, and this nurse was a terrorist,
I think Aaron and I having participated in the global war on terror probably have similar feelings about what that word means, which is nothing. Doesn't mean anything. You call anybody a terrorist who is opposing you, and that's what they've been doing for a long time. So calling Good, this mother in Minneapolis, a terrorist, like moments after they murdered her, is like, give me a break. You guys haven't even done an investigation. You're not gonna do one, apparently. But like, it just kind of throws light on that word, which I feel like means almost nothing.
Yeah, it's a
It's
really watered down term.
Well, in the case of Middle East in particular, ever since we waded into that in 2002 or so, many of the, I mean, according to some of the information I've read from scholars, is about Muslim people who oppose the United States. They do it because they consider Americans crusaders. That was Bin Laden was said as much. He says, "Don't stay out of Saudi Arabia," he says, "or I'm going to come after you." And they did. And they don't do it for religious reasons, particularly. It's nationalist or chauvinistic sort of what they think of an invader is. And the United States, by many people in the Middle East, is viewed as an invader, a crusader. That doesn't go away.
Again, like, don't want to be called a crusader. Don't act like one.
No.
Don't get crusader tattoos. All right.
Yeah. So, are there do you have much opportunity to talk to the families of these deported or incarcerated veterans?
When Zahed was detained, we had really close relationship with Zahed's wife, Melissa, who ran for Congress. You might recognize the name Melissa
Yes.
Chaudhry. We had close relationships with her. I think Matt talks pretty regularly to Godfrey's attorney and fiance. I talk to Garnett's fiance pretty regularly. And just tonight, I was talking to Tech's cousin, Wilson, at the detention center, because he was also there visiting Tech when I was there tonight. So we do have contact with the families. We often relay information back and forth from the families to the detained veterans. We're able for the veterans that are detained at Northwest Detention Center, we're able to communicate through a messaging app called Getting Out. You have to pay like 38 cents per message, but you can message back and forth through the app. And Godfrey had that app when he was in Georgia, but now that he was recently moved to Louisiana, he doesn't have that access to communicate with us anymore. So we don't actually know how he's doing in Louisiana right now. We just know that's where he was moved. We haven't been able to communicate with him yet. So there's some concern about his well-being there because he was just getting over pneumonia recently. He had a really bad case of pneumonia that was neglected by the medics at the detention center in Georgia. They were not giving him any treatment for it. They were giving him Tylenol for fevers, but no antibiotics for the pneumonia itself. So he got quite sick before they finally got him treatment. And that kind of medical violence in the detention centers is actually incredibly common. Zahed had thyroid eye disease that wasn't being treated and was losing his eyesight until he was released and finally was able to access treatment. The medical violence in these detention centers is extreme. They are just not able to access the kind of care that they need for chronic or acute issues. So they get much worse, both because of the neglect and the stress of the environment and the poor food. And so people get quite sick, and obviously people have died. 2025 was the deadliest year in ICE detention camps since they started putting people on them.
Well, these camps, there's probably some deliberate neglect, but also they're just not equipped to deal with. They don't have the medical staff to deal with this huge number of people that are just stuck into a warehouses, basically, and normal
They're
sort
also it's a network of private for-profit detention centers
of.
as well as federally operated centers. So what Aaron was saying about the means to communicate with detainees vary depending on which company is profiting off of their detention. So providing medical care is expensive. These are for-profit institutions. They are making money by housing human beings, and I find that abhorrent personally. I don't think it should be legal. But you know, I spoke, I communicated with text, via text with Godfrey's fiance this morning, and you know, he needs money. You know, they have commissaries at all these places, and we've been able to put some money, some resources from About Face, towards some of the folks who are in the Northwest Detention Center who are now members of our organization. Godfrey's a little bit older, doesn't fall in our post 9/11 membership. So that's one of the things that I'm hoping by reaching out to Veterans for Peace is that maybe, you know, one, we can find some sympathetic folks to help him, and two, his lawyer specifically asked me to try to find people who served with him. And he was in the Army during the 80s, 1983 to 1987. He was in a unit called the Cotton Balers, 17 Infantry Regiment Echo Company. They were deployed in Germany. I don't remember exactly where, but if there's anybody in Veterans for Peace who happened to be a cotton baler back then, I would love to hear from them, just for, character statements to for his lawyers to use in his ongoing legal battle.
So I don't know if the VFP National Newsletter has covered this at all. I mean, there's a fairly recent one. Do you know if they have written have got an article, some journalism about this issue in the National VFP National Newspaper?
They have. Godfrey's not aware of it. When we first reached out to Godfrey, the first thing he told me when I messaged him is that he thought everybody had forgotten about him and abandoned him. And he
Oh.
was so grateful that veterans remembered that he was there and had reached out, because he felt just abandoned by his country and abandoned by his military comrades. So I don't think that anybody has reached out to do any kind of media about him from VFP yet.
Well, one of the things I do is provide the chapter report to the National for their newspaper, and I know the editor, Becky Lewing, and if you or somebody else in your organization could actually give a synopsis, a few paragraphs about what's happening, and with some names or something like that, a straightforward sort of journalism way, I'll make sure that Becky knows about this and gets it into that newspaper also. I'm also a contact with the older organization, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. They are basically a defunct organization organizationally, but they still produce a newspaper. So if you've got some text, straightforward sort of text, 1,500 words or something like that, I'll do my best to make sure that gets a wider distribution to those two organizations, these two organizations.
That would be great.
What's the other guy? I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, the other thing is that, Matt, you mentioned an earlier email about sort of contact information to a couple of organizations or for more information. This is, and I didn't. I don't know. I'm not that technologically advanced, so I could put this in a chat G. But you can you. What would be the organization? What would be the link that people could go to find out more about this issue online?
There's a reporter, Savannah Levins, who's working out of Georgia, who's been publicizing Godfrey's case. He's got a GoFundMe set up. Tech and Garnett have fundraising sites set up through the Immigration and Migrants. Immigrant and Migrants Alliance, is that right, Aaron?
International Migrants Alliance.
Sorry, I just
No
had
worries.
the acronym. There's a lot of acronyms, and I'm not great at that. But getting more information about these detained veterans right now, like, there's very little media coverage, which is why it's why we're having this press conference on the 30th to bring more attention. And I feel like the more attention that can be brought could help us to find other detained veterans. And I feel like the Zahid, his case was special, but the amount of media attention on his situation, I think, helped him to get out. So any coverage we can get about these detained veterans will not hurt them. The people who are doing these abductions, kidnappings, whatever, they're hiding. They're afraid. They won't show their faces, right? I mean, they don't want people to know about this. They don't want to be embarrassed. Kristi Noem lied to Congress. Like, she Aaron said this, but she stated the Department of Homeland Security does not deport U.S. citizens or military veterans. And she said that on January 20th, I mean, there were already eight veterans that have been removed that we know of at that point. So like these people are not not terribly smart. They're not particularly even good at being fascists compared to some other fascists who were at least organized. And they're not, they don't want people to know what they're doing. And they're when they get called out, they tend to back down. You know, they don't want the spotlight on them because they know what they're doing is wrong. Like they know it.
Yeah, Matt, you touched on the incompetence of these agents. There was a situation where an immigrant named Kuya G, a Filipino national, had to be hospitalized because of the medical violence that we've already touched on. And while he was hospitalized at St. Joseph's Medical Center in Tacoma, he was under armed guard by ICE agents. And an ICE agent went to the bathroom and left his weapon on the floor of the bathroom for 6 hours until it was recovered by a nurse. So for 6 hours, he did not realize that he lost a loaded firearm in a hospital where anybody could have picked it up and been harmed. Luckily, a union nurse found it and called the police, and nobody was hurt, but the potential for harm was grave. And it is just astounding the level of incompetence that you did not notice that your loaded firearm was not on your hip for 6 hours. Like, that is not a highly trained organization. I was an MP and carried a sidearm, and let me tell you, I was obsessive about checking that it was there. And you notice that the weight's gone. Like, a loaded weapon is a pretty heavy thing on your hip. You notice the weight's missing. Like, the level of incompetence to lose a firearm is just insane.
Just having that many firearms around with people who are probably not very well trained in their use, I mean, like a lot of people carry these Glocks, which those things don't have any safeties on them anymore. You pick it up and pull the trigger. So, what was the other thing I was going to say? The other thing is. You mentioned Como radio or TV that they've been in touch with you locally here about talking about this issue.
King Five,
King Five.
the station out of Atlanta, was 11 Alive. That reporter I reached out to initially to make contact with Godfrey, and she's been keeping his story in the news out there. And so we've been talking, and she contacted the King Five newsroom out here to make an introduction. And so I don't have the reporter's name in front of me here, but I've been in contact with a reporter from King Five who's going to be doing some coverage of our press conference. Also, it's a heads ongoing battle, and yeah, the situation that both Tech and Garnett are caught up in, which is just a kind of Kafka-esque weird.
Well, depending on who you talk to, I don't know. Do you familiar with the name Bridget Chavez? Chavez? She actually came out and interviewed me and Dan Gilman about the Blue Angels, and did a little short piece on was it Como? I think it was, or maybe anyway, she did.
The reporter for King Five is named Sharon.
Oh, Sharon Yu.
Yeah, Sharon
Yeah.
Yu.
Yeah, she has previously covered Tech's case. And hopefully, we'll continue to cover this issue.
Well, I can mention you and both of your names to Bridget Chavez because she did a pretty good job. She's a regular reporter on the TV, and she might be able to bump the story up a little bit. I'll tell her that you're available, and I'll give them your emails if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, any
Anyway,
press coverage is helpful.
yeah. Well, this is right on point here for closing arms. So this is a KODX 96.9 FM Vietnam the Veterans for Peace radio show with Aaron Miracle and Matt Rhodes of About Face. We look forward to hearing more from you about this issue. So thanks again.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay.